Hello guys, this is Paul, the host of Beyond the Paradigm. I hope you're enjoying the show, and if you are, I hope you're following me on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you are following me, could you leave me a 5-star rating, as it really helps the show to appear higher up in the list when people are searching for things to listen to. And it does take me a lot of hours to produce each episode, and there are costs incurred in doing this podcast. So I wonder if you would actually consider supporting this show financially. I have set up a Patreon, and you can become a patron of the show. I've just added one tier at the moment. For $3 or £2.50 or €2.85, you can keep this show on air. Like I said, there are costs involved, but also as part of this tier, you will be given a shout out on the show. And you'll also get voting rights to vote on what types of topics you would like to see in the future on this show. But if you're not able to support this podcast financially, sort of in a recurring monthly amount, I've also set up a Buy Me a Coffee page where you can just simply buy me a coffee, and it's £3 on there. And it's just a simple donation to help the show. So you go to buymeacoffee.com and it's /beyondthep5. I'll drop the link in the episode description and the link for the Patreon and all other relevant links there. And in today's episode, guys, I'm joined by a guest, Floyd Wills. Floyd is the author of The Red-Haired Giants of Lovelock Cave and Other Ancient Mysteries. He's also an explorer, and his investigations have led him to sacred sites and also to study out-of-place artifacts, and have led him actually across the globe. So without further ado, let's get Floyd onto the show.
We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
Welcome to the show, Floyd.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank you for having me on, and thanks to your audience for tuning in.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. Got to say, first of all, I love talking about the giants, and it's proving to be a popular topic with my listeners. I did an episode myself on ancient giants, just me on my own. And then I've also had a couple of guests on as well speaking about giants. One of them's going out tomorrow, but I had a gentleman on from the Giants of Ancient America, and that proved very popular. So I would imagine that this also is definitely going to be a popular episode. But just to start off with, Floyd, when did you first become interested in giants?
I think it started back when I was a young boy. There was a popular television show on in the late 70s, early 80s called In Search Of, and it was hosted by Leonard Nimoy. And they had all kinds of interesting subjects on ancient civilizations, UFOs, Bigfoot, that type of thing. So it started from back when I was a young boy, and I'd always been interested in mythology and ancient legends. So I would say it started back when I was a young boy. And then I would say this is about 10 years ago, I heard a presentation by Jim Vieira, who's another researcher on giant skeletons, and a very good one at that. And I was just amazed at the information that he was presenting. And he was bringing forth a lot of these old newspaper articles that he had gathered regarding these anomalous discoveries. And I was curious, and I thought, this is amazing. Is there any truth to this? And, you know, if he can find these old newspaper articles, you know, I'm going to go online and try to do it myself and see what I find. And then I started compiling a lot of research on these ancient skeletons, giant skeletons. And so that really piqued my interest. And that is a central story of the book I decided to write about them.
Yeah, Jim Vieri, I've started watching a documentary that he's done with his brother. You've probably seen it. I think I've only seen a couple of episodes on that. I found it interesting. I have heard him on a couple of other podcasts as well with Hugh Newman. I believe they wrote a book together. I think it's The Giants of Stonehenge in Ancient Britain. They
Yes,
did
they've
write
written
that one.
several books.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Jim and his brother are stonemasons, and in the
Yeah.
part of the United States they live, the eastern part, they would find these strange stone structures out in the woods. And so they started researching into that, and they would go to the county historical society in that area, and then and that's when they started stumbling on these old reports of giant skeletons.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that actually about them being stonemasons because I remember listening to a particular episode where Jim was talking about Stonehenge and he mentioned that one of the, I can't remember which stone it was in the inner circle, but he said when you examine this particular stone, it looks as almost as if there's been like a scooped out of it. Like when you look at it, not it's not been chiseled out, it's like it. As if it's been scooped out. And I have sort of heard how possibly when you look at, for example, some of the stone structures in Cusco in Peru, and you look at how they fit together, there's
Yes.
no mortar between the joints.
There is
And this
not.
is, yeah, and it's, I've heard, I mean, I don't know if you've heard this as well, that it's almost like they may have been heated to such a degree that they were almost became marshmallow-like and fit them together that way.
I've heard that, Paul, and if you look at those big stone walls in Sacsayhuaman, they are like these odd shaped puzzle pieces that are perfectly fit together, like you said, and you couldn't even get a razor blade in between these megalithic stones.
It's a fascinating topic. I've had a look at a lot of pictures online, and I've got intent. I missed out on going Stonehenge this year, foolishly. I was down that way. We went on holiday. We took the train down there, and where we stopped in the hotel prior is like two stops down from where you would get. You basically have to get a bus from a station to Stonehenge. But I was so tired when I got there and it was so busy. I was said to my wife, I can't go back and then regretted it after. So I'm definitely going to Stonehenge next year. But you've wrote the book, you know, The Red-Haired Giants of Lovelock Cave and Other Ancient Mysteries. What was your motivation regarding writing this book, like regarding these red-haired giants?
Yes, that particular story of the Lovelock Cave really intrigued me, Paul, because there is a lot of documentation on a number of different levels. On the archaeological level, there's artifacts that you can still see in Nevada that came out of that cave. There are photographs that researchers have taken of some of these skulls that allegedly came out of the cave. And then you have a rich Paiute, Northern Paiute tradition of these red-haired giants. So, out of a lot of the giant skeleton articles that I researched, this story seemed to have some of the most compelling evidence. And so that's where I wanted to really focus on. And in fact, I even dialogued with one of the head anthropologists in Nevada that was seemed to be open-minded concerning the red-haired giants. And I do include some of that dialogue in my book. And he provided me with some very interesting information on these red-haired giants, and but it got to a point where I think I started asking too many questions, and then the communication just suddenly just stopped.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I'm sort of familiar with the story myself. I have read a little bit on it, and you mentioned there was many artifacts found, and I've read about that as well. But could you actually tell us what actually happened with these red-haired giants at Lovelock Cave?
Absolutely. Well, the Northern Paiute tradition talks about a race of red-haired giants that lived in that area, and they called them various names. One of them is called Satika, which Satika is a water plant, and there used to be a giant lake in that area that was very marshy. And these giants would, fish from the lake. They would eat the water plants. They would use these water plants to make various things like basketry, clothing, even duck decoys. There were duck decoys that came out of Lovelock Cave that were really astonishing the way they were constructed. In fact, one of the anthropologists said that the level of detail that was put into these duck decoys seemed to go far beyond what was even necessary, to make a duck decoy. And so there were these giants that lived in this area, and they were very violent, and they attacked neighboring tribes. And not only were they violent, but they were cannibalistic. They would eat their victims. And finally, the Paiutes got tired of being attacked, and they allied with other local tribes, and they waged war on these red-haired giants that lasted for 3 years. And the final battle culminated at the Lovelock Cave, where the last of the red-haired giants were cornered, and brush was thrown in front of the cave entrance, and flaming arrows were lit. And the Paiutes gave these red-haired giants, these Satika, an ultimatum. They said, "Why don't you stop what you're doing? Why don't you live like men?" And no response came out of the cave, and they shot the flaming arrows, and allegedly it burnt to death the remaining giants. Now, in 1911, some guano miners were mining Lovelock Cave, and guano is bat dung for those that don't know what that is. And they uncovered they discovered these skeletons and artifacts, and then they called the local university, which did an excavation in 1912, and thousands of artifacts came out of the cave. And a number of giant skeletons, around 60 skeletons, I believed, were reported in the archaeological record that came out of that cave. The skeletons disappeared. The artifacts were distributed to several different museums, some of which you can see to this day. But what I thought was interesting is there was a museum in that area, Humboldt Museum, that allegedly ended up with a few of the skulls that came out of the cave, and they were kept in a basement, and they were never put on public display, and you had to ask to go see these skulls, which I thought was very odd. And when I reached out to the museum to ask them if they still had those skulls there, they claimed that they didn't, that they had to repatriate those skulls back to the native peoples, and they no longer had them. And when I asked them why they were never put on public display, the answer I received was that due to the current politics, that museum could lose their funding if they displayed those Native American remains, which didn't make sense to me because they had those remains for many years, 50, 60, or even longer years, and they were never put on display. I could understand in the current political, climate now. But going back all those decades, it didn't make sense that they were never put on public display.
Yeah, it seems to be an ulterior motive, obviously, because you always get the question, well, what's happened to the bones? But you mentioned artifacts and you mentioned these duck decoys. Were there any weapons found at all?
There were weapons, yes, there were projectile points that were found. And interesting enough, there was actually an addle-addle that was found. One of those spear throwers. It was a pre bow projectile weapon that was used, and an addle-addle was found out of the cave. Unfortunately, they do not know where the addle-addle is, so you can no longer see that. But it is mentioned in the one of the earlier archaeological records.
Yeah. I mean, the bones, like I mentioned just before, and I remember the scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark where they boxed the ark up. I said it to one of my guests. We were talking about giants again, and we were talking about the bones and the same thing,
Yes.
you know. And you could just imagine, because obviously there's the Smithsonian Institute and the theory that they're hiding the bones. I mean, what's your take on that? Regarding like where these bones have gone.
I do think there's some truth that institutions like the Smithsonian have covered up these types of discoveries. And I think it has to do more with what I call knowledge filtration. And I talk about this in my book. And it's basically, when you've been taught a certain paradigm, and in your mind, this is how it is. Anything that falls outside of this paradigm if it doesn't fit into this box, then it's just it can't be true, it can't be real. And so in the universities, a certain paradigm, a certain dogma is taught, and anything that falls outside or doesn't match with that is just simply it's not true, it's got to be a hoax, it's just an anomaly. And so I think automatically a lot of academics, they have this mindset that if it doesn't fit in with what they're taught, it's automatically filtered out. And it's much easier to kind of box things up or sweep things under the rug than to really go in and do research and have open discussions, on these types of subjects.
Yeah, they definitely can't have open discussions. I mean, my opinion is that if they were to admit there were giants, then that shatters the whole theory of evolution, which is what they're
Yeah.
trying to protect.
Yes.
And also they're trying to protect their own funding, because if you start to deviate from the accepted paradigm, the one that they've set up, they want us. This is why my podcast is called Beyond the Paradigm, because
Yeah.
the paradigm or the framework, it's been set up by, them, the Illuminati, whoever they are. Yeah, it's been set up
Yes.
by them, and like you said about information filtration, and that's what's going on. So there's definitely a cover up, because it's just a there's too many stories. I keep saying this to people, there's too many stories about giants for it not to be true. But I mean, number one, I believe it because it's in the Bible. As a Christian, it tells us there
Yes.
were giants in the earth. There was,
Genesis
it even
6.
named, yeah, it even names some of them, Goliath, Og.
Yes.
It names tribes of them, the Rephaim, Anakims. So we know
Amorites.
that Amorites, yeah, there's many tribes of them. So we know that for the fact there were giants. I mean, I've even spoken to some Christians, and the same thing. Well, where are the bones? And I'm like, but there were giants, because we believe the Bible, so we know. And for me, it's quite simple that like some people are going to say, well, what's the reason for them to hide these bones? Well, the devil doesn't want us to believe in giants, because if we believe in giants, the book that talks about them originally is the Bible. So then we're going to be like, well, maybe the Bible's relevant, and we'll have a look at it, and he doesn't want us to. So
Right.
it's right back to the Garden of Eden, isn't it? Has God said? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Has God really said this? So, and I think that's the reason, that's my conclusion to it all, because there wouldn't be any other reason. I mean, obviously you've got your human reasons at the human level. It's like, well, I need to get some money for my funding,
Yes.
If they cut my funding off, I won't be able to carry on, and it's the same thing with probably when we had the COVID lockdown, same thing, the scientists who deviate from the accepted narrative, same thing.
They're
But one of
censored,
the
absolutely.
yeah, it's just absolute censorship, which is obviously what's happening now online with a lot of things. But you also talk in your book, and I don't know too much about this, but it's an interesting topic, and I've started to look into it. How to place artifacts. Could you tell us actually what is meant by that term?
Yeah, it goes into what you were just talking about, Paul, with these skeletons of giants that don't fit in with the standard theory of evolution, the standard the way that archaeology or ancient history is taught. And these things are they don't fit in with that paradigm. And so these are artifacts that don't maybe they don't match the timeline. Maybe they have a technology that shouldn't have been developed at that particular time. Maybe they portray things in carvings that the ancient people should not have even known about.
On your website, I read this, and I believe it's chapter one of your book, and you've wrote on your website, history is not what we've been told. Could you elaborate on this and give your opinion as to why the history we've been taught is a lie, and like that historical facts are actually being hidden from us?
Yeah, I think those in power, can manipulate history, can cover history up, and create their own narrative to whatever they want to to portray. And it all ties in with the whole topic of the whether it's giant skeletons being covered up. You had mentioned, there's fears of, well, we should keep this under wraps because, if there are giants, then this definitely validates what's in the Bible. And if you're based on a, theory of evolution, you're not gonna, you're not gonna want to go down that road. And so, whoever controls the past can control the future, and whoever controls the present controls the past. So it's all about, controlling history and manipulating history. We see it here in the United States now with history being attempted to be rewritten. We have statues, historical statues being pulled down, books being taken out, historical books being taken out of the library and banned. So right now we're experiencing that as a society.
Yeah, it's the same thing over here, actually. We had an incident back in England with a statue of a guy called Edward Colston, and they pulled that down. And the reason for it, they said, was because he had links to the slave trade. However, what they don't tell you about him, he set up a lot of orphanages and things like that. And his actual links to the slave trade are quite dubious. He may have done business with someone who knew someone who was a slave trader. And they don't know whether he was actually a slave trader or not. But like you said, it's this rewriting of history and, burning of books and changing our language as well. And obviously, this we're talking obviously about paradigms and how things don't fit in. And obviously, there's these outer place artifacts that you gave as a definition of. Could you tell us about the Ica stones?
Yes, the Ica stones are there's thousands and thousands of these Ica stones in Peru, and they were first talked about back in the 1500s by the Spaniards, and they would sometimes call them dragon stones. These were stones that had unusual carvings of reptilian looking beings, and the only thing they could equate it to in their mind would be dragons, so they would call them dragon stones. They really came forward to the public. It was back in the 60s and 70s. There was an area in Peru called Ica, which is near Nazca, Peru, which probably many people are familiar with the Nazca lines, the giant glyphs, on the ground that you have to be, way up above them to even see what the symbols are. So these stones were allegedly burial stones, and they were sometimes found in rivers, and they depicted ancient man interacting with dinosaurs, sometimes fighting dinosaurs, sometimes riding dinosaurs. And there was all kinds of other unusual carvings of open heart surgery. There were stones that had depictions of it looked like Pangaea, of like a supercontinent. Before the continents were broken up. Very, very unusual. There's another one that had a depiction of an ancient man using a telescope. And so all kinds of interesting things that really shouldn't be there. And obviously, since their discovery, there's been a lot of controversy. A lot of people say, oh, these are fake. They were just made for tourists, to sell to tourists, and other people say these things are real. Maybe some of them were fake. Maybe, some of them were fabricated to sell to tourists. But there are ancient burial stones that do depict these reptilian beings and other unusual things.
I've had a quick look into it actually, and it is a fascinating topic. And I was reading that because obviously you said people saying, "Oh, the fakes," but for them to have been faked, there would have had to have been one stone carved every single day for 40 years to get to the amount that they've got now.
And there's a museum in Ica. Dr. Cabrera was his name. He became fascinated with these stones. He was given one for his birthday back in the 60s, and it had an unusual fish. And he and Cabrera was interested in archaeology amongst many other subjects. And he looked in his library, and he looked at the image of the fish that was on there and determined that it was a prehistoric type fish. And so he went to the person that gave him the stone. I think it was a farmer or a group of farmers, and asked them if they can go find more stones, or if they found more stones like this, he would like to purchase them. And so he started acquiring these thousands and thousands of very unusual stones. Now, I know back in the, I think it was 70s or 80s, there was a gentleman there in Peru that admitted to Eric von Däniken, another famous ufologist researcher, that he did fabricate some of these stones, that he used a Dremel to carve these things in the stone, and then he would bake them in like chicken dung. And but what's interesting about that is he didn't come out and claim that he had made these things until the local Peruvian authorities were investigating him for selling ancient artifacts. And then all of a sudden, it went from, oh, these are ancient artifacts, to no, I was just fabricating these. And some people claim that he said that because he actually wanted to avoid going to prison. So it's up in the air.
And you also mentioned some other out of place artifacts, which I've also looked into, and very interesting, like the Ica stones that is it Acambaro dinosaur
Yes,
figurines.
Acambro dinosaur figurines, and I did see those. I had a one of my late friends, Dr. Charles Spurgeon, took me to that museum over there in Mexico, and that's an interesting story. Allegedly, these dinosaur figurines were found in the 40s by a German immigrant who lived over there, Waldemar Julsrud. He was out horseback riding, and he had an interest in archaeology as well, and he had done some amateur excavations in the area where he lived. And he one day he was out horseback riding, he saw something protruding from the ground, and he got up off of his horse, and he dug this thing out of the ground, and it was an unusual looking figure. And then he started him and his friends started digging around this particular area and started finding all these really unusual figurines of reptilian type figurine. Again, it's very kind of similar to the Ica stones, except that these aren't carved on stones. These were actually ceramic type figurines.
Yeah, I've been having a look at some pictures of them, and one of them looks like a triceratops with a man riding it. I mean, that
Yes.
if these things are genuine, that changes everything.
That changes everything exactly. And I know that some of the these figurines, their tails were sticking kind of straight out and not dragging on the ground. And skeptics gave that a lot of criticism and said, oh, the dinosaurs, their tails didn't do that. But it wasn't until decades later that it was determined that yes, there is some truth that some of the dinosaurs, their tails did kind of stick out and didn't necessarily drag on the ground. And so some of these figurines, depicted that. And also it was criticized for some of the figures having dorsal fins. And back at that time, it was thought that no dinosaurs had dorsal fins. But since then, decades and decades later, it determined that yes, there were some dinosaurs that had dorsal fins.
Yeah, I've like I said, I've read a little bit into it, and I watched a couple of YouTube videos, but I listened to one by Michael Heiser, and he says that the fakes, surprisingly, and obviously they supposedly sent the Mexican government sent their own archaeologist down there, but I read that this guy's obviously gone down there, and he's only spent about 4 hours there, and he's gone, yeah, the fakes. And it's like, how do you know that after 4 hours?
Right, and there was thousands and thousands of these artifacts.
Yeah, and I mean, the Mexican government basically want to ignore them now, don't they? And apparently they're prohibiting any excavations in that area.
Yes, there was a famous researcher, Charles Hapgood. Are you familiar with him?
I've heard the name, but
Yes, he actually wrote a book on the subject back in the 70s or 80s. He did an investigation himself. He was an anthropologist, and he had a lot of other degrees as well. And he actually went to Acambro and did his own excavations. And he claimed that they were authentic. He believed they were from an unrecognized ancient civilization, and that was kind of their library, so to speak, not in the form of books, but in the form of these figurines.
thank you. When you were just talking then, did you say you had a friend called Charles Spurgeon?
Charles Spurgeon, yes. And I didn't, when I met him, I didn't even know that he was a famous evangelist, and I had no idea. And my late friend Charles, he was a really interesting character. He was a theologian. He was a ufologist. He had a degree in biblical archaeology. Just a really, really fascinating guy. Knew him for a few years before he passed, but really interesting guy. He actually shared with me some of his research on the Nephilim, and that's what really got me interested into the Nephilim. So I dedicated my book to his research and to my friendship with him.
Yeah, because when you said that, obviously I thought, oh, I've got some books on my shelf by Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the famous English preacher. We used to, he was called the Prince of Preachers. That's what they used to call him.
I didn't even make the connection until quite some time later.
Talking about connections, actually, what, and we'll go back to the giants. What connection is there with giants and fraternal societies?
Okay, this gets really interesting, Paul, because in the archaeological record of the first excavation of Lovelock Cave, they said the largest of the mummies, the largest of the specimens, was given to a fraternal lodge to be boiled and used in initiation rites. And I'm thinking, what on earth is going on here? Because the public can't even see these skeletons, these mummies that came out. But yet, in the archaeological record, it's saying the biggest one that they found that was given to a fraternal lodge to be used in ritual purposes.
Wow, that's insane.
It's
I
in,
mean,
it's in,
what
yeah.
was it like
Go
the
ahead.
Freemasons they gave it to? Who was it?
Well, they didn't in the archaeological re in the records, it didn't specify. It just said fraternal lodge. And so I did a little bit of investigation, and I contacted the historical society in that area of Lovelock and asked them, around the early 1900s, around 1911, what fraternal lodges were in this area? Because I figured if they were given to a fraternal lodge, it would most likely be a lodge in that vicinity. And there were two. There were was one called the Knights Pythias, and then there were the Freemasonic Lodge that was there. And I thought, well, this is interesting. I would like to do some research into both of these organizations and see if there's any evidence of using human remains for ritual purposes. And I was surprised on both accounts. In the Knights Pythias, I did discover one reference to a skeleton being used in one of their rituals. But when I looked into the Freemasons, I actually found a lot of evidence. And not only that, but there were probably within the past 10 or 15 years, there were a number of Masonic lodges in Australia that got into trouble because there was renovations being done on those lodges, and the workmen saw that there was human skeletons and other human bones, so they reported it to the police. And then the police did an investigation and come to find out they were real skeletal remains of ancient Aboriginal people there in Australia. And the Freemasons came out and they said, oh, we just use these human remains to teach our members, the importance of using their time wisely because time is fleeting. And so that was, yeah, that's what they said. And I thought, wow, something doesn't seem right here. And why would you even need to use humans, human bones to come across this with this principle to your members?
Because like ordinary people do that often, don't we? To teach, we use human remains to teach people about time.
Exactly. And not only that, Paul, but I found out when I was doing some research into the Masonic Lodge and some of these other fraternal societies back in the early 1900s, they would actually encourage their members to donate their remains after they died to those lodges. And I had no idea that that ever happened.
Yeah, the Freemasons is what I'm going to start looking into because I actually live right near a Masonic lodge. Like, I mean, 2 minutes away from my house. And I've actually planned, I'm going to go in and interview someone there. And I've been having people say to me, "Oh, don't do that. You might not reappear out of there." And I'm like, "I'll be okay."
I think you'll
But now
be
that you've
okay.
mentioned, yeah. But then when you were saying about human remains in the lodge, I thought, should I really be doing this?
Just be wary if they invite you for dinner, right?
I know, yeah. Or do I see any
No.
rooms with no handles on the other side? I won't be going in them rooms. You,
That's right.
you've 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 studied the Freemasons a bit, haven't you? I believe.
I have, yes. I was interested for a period of time in the Knights Templar, and through the study of the Knights Templar, I crossed paths with the Masonic Lodge because I believe, based on my research, that the Templars morphed into Freemasonry. That when they were fleeing from Europe, where they were being hunted down by the King of France, and there was orders given on Friday the 13th, 1307, to have them arrested because the King of France, number one, wanted to eliminate all the debt that was owed to the Templars, and he can solve that problem by bringing these accusations that they were, devil worshippers and these other accusations. So he could nip that in the bud, and he was also worried about their military strength, and so he wanted to eliminate them as any kind of threat, and had the Pope, a puppet Pope that was he put in place at that time, to bring these charges against the Templars. Now I'm not standing up for them and saying that they were completely innocent or guilty. But it is a really interesting subject, and I think when they were fleeing, fleeing France, that they did go to Scotland, and they did take their main bulk of their treasure, and they did get away with it. That was never found, and I believe that those were holy relics. I believe that they could be ancient documents that perhaps they uncovered when they were over in the Middle East. Some people believe that they were stationed initially when they were over there on the top of Solomon's temple, and there were tunnels that went underneath there, and they somehow did some excavation and uncovered different relics and scrolls, and then brought that information into Europe.
How much influence do you think Freemasons still have?
Oh, they have a lot of they I believe they do have a lot of influence, and I think there's even a degree in Masonry that references the Templars and in their symbolism. There was a great book out of a gentleman out of the UK, and I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but he did a really good book called Born in Blood, and I read that book. It came out probably, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe longer, and he really did a lot of research showing the specific connections between the Knights Templar and Freemasonry.
Yeah, it's. I was talking to a friend at church a couple of weeks back, and he was telling me about a gentleman he knows who's an ex-Mason, who's and he's now a Christian. But he was saying that, I mean, they do have a lot of influence, and this story sort of proves it, that he was taken to hospital on this particular occasion, and they actually had like special wards for Freemasons. And this particular ward that they had at their hospital, this is in England, it was like underground. But
Interesting.
he didn't, he felt in his spirit, he said that he shouldn't go there, and he refused to be taken down to that ward. He just had this sense, overwhelming sense of evil. And it, you know, a lot of these politicians, I suppose, are supposed Freemasons. I mean, is that something you've heard as well?
Yes, it runs deep. I mean, a lot of the founders of the United States were Freemasons. Our first president, George Washington, he was a Freemason. You could see pictures of him with a Masonic apron on.
Right. I didn't know. I'd heard that, but then
Yeah.
I'd been told, "Oh, he's a Christian." But then I've been told, "No, he wasn't. He was a Freemason."
Sure. Yeah, in Freemasonry, what they say is they will let it, well, first off, you have to be referred. You just can't walk in the door and become a Freemason. You have to be referred. You have to be sponsored, and one of their requirements is you do have to believe in a supreme being, whether that's God, whether that's whatever you believe, you have to believe in a supreme being. So that's one of their requirements.
There's different degrees, isn't there? And they move up.
There's
What's that all about?
There's different degrees, and with each degree, the initiate learns more and more of the symbolism of Freemasonry. And there's a lot of hidden, supposed hidden knowledge in this symbolism, in the words, in the symbols. And as you advance in degrees, more and more of that is revealed to you. Now, the Freemasons will say, we are not a secret society. They say this, we are a society with secrets. And the Freemasons also claim their knowledge goes all the way back to the ancient mystery schools.
Do you think the Illuminati, do you think that's the same as the Freemasons, or what do you think who do you think the Illuminati are? Because obviously, I mean, most people have heard about Illuminati.
Yes.
And they're a secret society.
Yes.
But do they relate to the Freemasons?
Yeah, that was a secret society that originally supposedly came out of Bavaria, and they were going to infiltrate. They did infiltrate some Freemasonic lodges. And so I don't know a tremendous amount about the Illuminati, but I know there are definitely some differences to Freemasonry. But in my belief is that it all goes back, all of it, whether it's the Illuminati, whether it's Freemasons, it does go back to the ancient mystery schools.
Is it Baphomet? That's the sort of, is either God in Freemasonry, or what's Baphomet? I have read a little bit on it, and I've sort of seen a picture of what this thing looks like, but what is Baphomet?
Well, Baphomet was one of the things that the Templars were accused of worshiping, and it was like an androgynous looking type of being, almost like a demonic type looking being. And also too, the Templars were accused of worshiping a severed head. That was one of the charges one of the many charges that was brought up against, you know, against the Templars. But again, I think all of that stuff, Baphomet, that all goes back to the ancient mystery schools, and I think these can be traced back to, you know, even what's talked about in the Bible, Baal. You have these different ancient demonic beings that were worshipped by different cultures, and I think they trace back to these ancient, I call them demonic beings that the Bible talks about.
Yeah, I mean, it all goes back to Genesis chapter 6, doesn't it? You know, the sons of God that came down. I've spoke about this with a few guests. And you mentioned you was in like to mythology and things like that. And I have said to people that these myths, they're based on facts. These fallen sons of God, these are the gods of old that people used to worship. This is where you get your mythology from. This is where Zeus comes from and Poseidon.
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, there were the Titans, right? They were the giant beings that waged war against the gods. And then they were destroyed. They were imprisoned in the volcanoes. They were imprisoned in the earth. And how similar does that sound to the Nephilim, the fallen angels, and allegedly the watchers that are the ones that interacted with humankind and produced the giants? And then they were punished. The watchers were punished, and they were put in chains under the earth.
Yeah. Peter mentions it, and it's the only time in the Bible he talks about the angels that sin being obviously bound in chains in Tartarus.
Yes.
Now, the King James Version translates it as hell, but actually in the margins, it's the only time it's used, and it's Tartarus. And I mean, I've heard all kinds of theories regarding Tartarus, you know, that it's obviously in the bowels of the earth. I mean, some people believe it's in Antarctica.
Yes. Yeah, interesting theories. And yeah, could it be? Could it be in another dimension? Who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting because it talks about these chains, and I've often considered, what are these chains? I mean, it can't mean actual physical chains, but I've heard it described that these chains are all, it's basically God has given commandment that they can't leave this place, so they're bound in that way, these original watchers. And I was speaking with Ryan Peterson, the episode will be out tomorrow, and we were talking about these watches that come down, and obviously the Book of Enoch says there were 200 of them.
Yes.
But interestingly, Satan wasn't part of that actual insurrection. But we do know that obviously he's the leader. But in the Book of Enoch, it talks about Samyazer and Azazel. And when we were talking about Baphomet, I've seen depictions of Azazel, and they're very similar to Baphomet.
Yes. And it's very interesting because the knowledge that allegedly these watchers gave to humankind obviously wasn't something that God wanted us to have. And obviously there was a corruption in the human bloodline. And so this advanced knowledge, I believe this is the same knowledge that the Freemasons claim they have that goes back to the ancient times. I believe that it stems directly from that interaction with these watchers.
Yeah, I can see that myself, actually. Is it the 33 degrees? Is that the top one?
There's 33
Yeah.
degrees in Masonry. And from my understanding and from some communication I've had with members and former members, that really by the time you are in the upper, you have to be way up in the upper degrees before you really are given and not very many people make it up to the higher levels. A lot of people, they just kind of go through the rituals and they learn, the words they need to speak and the symbols that they're presented. But there's a body of hidden knowledge within that. And there's only a very, very small percentage at the top that really knows and understands the deeper meanings of these things. And it's my belief that what it comes down to, if you really just kind of boil it down, that their belief is that Lucifer wasn't the bad guy. Lucifer was the good guy. He was the guy that gave humankind the Promethean knowledge, right? And God is looked at as the tyrant, the one that wanted to keep us stupid, the one that wanted to keep us kind of suppressed. But Lucifer, the light bearer, that was, he was the one that came to want to liberate us. So that's, I think, at the upper levels, and I think it kind of goes with more of a Gnostic belief system, that that's actually what they believe. And as Christians, we understand, that Lucifer, the devil, is the father of lies. So he's going to flip everything, what's bad is good and what's good is bad.
Yeah, I've been meditating on that for quite a while about him being the father of lies. And I was talking to a friend last week and I was saying, we shouldn't be surprised if everything we've ever been taught's a lie, because Jesus obviously says that Satan is the father of lies and there's no truth in him at all. There's no light in him. He is darkness. He is the antithesis of Christ. And it's one of the things I've been considering, like, just how fake really is everything we're told. I mean, what's your opinion on that regarding, like, literally history, everything? I mean, how fake do you think it is? Do you think it's literally pretty much all a lie?
I'm not sure if I would quite go that far and say it's all a lie, but the more research that I do and look into it myself, kind of the more deception that I see. I'm a big fan of Graham Hancock too, and I love a lot of what he writes about, and one of his quotes, he says, the further back we look in our ancient history, the more and more it looks like a fairy tale compared to what we've been taught.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, I think C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, their books are actually closer to probably what the days of Noah were than we realize.
Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, I was talking to Ryan Peterson, I mentioned before, and I asked him the question regarding like centaurs and things like, you know, that hybrid type beings. And I said, do you believe they existed? And he said that he believed that they did, because it talks about these watchers that not only were they having, obviously, hybrid children with human women, but it says that all flesh was corrupted.
All flesh was corrupted, and they corrupted the plant and animal life. And to me, that awfully sounds a lot like some type of genetic engineering almost, in some form or another.
Yeah, because obviously, I mean, we have depictions of hybrid beings, you know, we know what centaurs. I mean, when I was in the army, the platoon I was in, on our insignia was a centaur.
Interesting.
You know, so I've said it to people and I keep saying it. These things haven't just been made up like literally from nowhere. I
Right.
believe that they're memories of an ancient time. And like you mentioned, Graham Hancock saying, the further we go back, the more it looks like a fairy tale.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, in the past probably 10, 15 years, there is actually archaeological evidence that is coming out. In the forms of the discovery of the Denisovans. Are you familiar with them?
I've heard about them, yeah, but could you elaborate on that for my audience who possibly don't know?
Absolutely. And I talk about the Denisovans in my book, and they were initially discovered in 2010. There were some archaeological excavations going on in a cave in Siberia, and there was a tooth that was discovered. It was twice the size of a human tooth, and there was a knuckle bone, some other bone fragments and artifacts that were found. There was a beautiful green stone bracelet that had 8 millimeter holes drilled into the bracelet, which was astonishing technology, because the bracelet dated back probably 40,000 years. And they did DNA sequencing on these bone fragments and determined that they were another like subspecies of us. Like we know about the Neanderthal, and we are told that Neanderthal interbred with our ancient ancestors. In fact, most of us will have some DNA of these Neanderthals in us. And now they've discovered, they call them the Denisovans, because it was discovered at the cave was called Denisovan Cave, that now they're finding DNA sequencing of Denisovans in certain populations, like in Papua New Guinea. And there's been some people in Europe that have Denisovan DNA, and some people in the Native American population have this these genetics in them. And recently, a full skull has been discovered in China. It's called they call it Homo Longi, which means dragon skull. Have you heard about that discovery?
I have heard about that, yeah. Could you
It's a
just
very
sort of
interesting.
elaborate a bit for my audience?
Yes, the skull was discovered in the 1930s. There was a Chinese man that found it. He was under forced labor by the Japanese. The Japanese had occupied this particular area of China, and he found the skull and he hid it. He put it in a well and didn't tell anybody about it. And this man lived to a very old age. And on his deathbed, he revealed to his children that he had found the skull and where it could be found. And so his children went and they pulled this thing out of the well, and then they gave it to the local university, which started doing the DNA sequencing. And they believe that it is at one of these Denisovan skulls, and it's massive. It's huge. It's a football shape, has very pronounced brow ridges, huge eyes, very much larger than a normal human skull. And so now they're telling us, the scientists are telling us, that these Denisovans were around during the time that our ancient ancestors lived. And they were interbreeding not only with the Neanderthals, but with our ancient ancestors as well. So who knows what kind of hybridization that could have created.
Yeah. So they sound almost like giants, like you were saying, the skull's
The
bigger.
skull, very big. Some researchers believe the average height of the Denisovans were about 7.5 feet tall.
So almost like a tribe of giants then, because we talk about the giants, but there weren't just the giants. We've spoken about obviously different tribes of giants. I was listening to a podcast a couple of weeks back, and there was a guest on the podcast, Dr. Laura Sanger, and she was saying that a lot of these, well, possibly royals or basically high up people in society, the ones who are at the top of the pecking order, the elite, that the some of these people have traces of Nephilim DNA still. They're not obviously not giants, but they're related to them. I mean, have you heard anything like that?
I have. And if you look at a lot of the hieroglyphs in ancient Egypt, you'll see a lot of the rulers depicted as being much larger than their subjects. They're sitting on a throne and their servants are standing before them. And the person sitting on the throne is just as tall as their servant. And so if they stood up, they would be twice that size. Now you can say, well, that's just a symbolic depiction of someone of importance. And it's very possible that that could be the case. But, you know, it could also be the case, too, that maybe, like you said, some of these elites in the upper echelons of that society, they were larger, they were taller. And in fact, in ancient Sumeria, I'm sure you've probably heard of the Anunnaki. And there are depictions of these alleged Anunnaki, and again, they're giants.
Just for my audience, who possibly might not know who the Anunnaki are, could you tell us who they are? I mean, I've read about them and I've heard theories about them as well, but could you just sort of give us a brief overview regarding them?
Absolutely. The Anunnaki were worshipped by the ancient Sumerian culture. And we're talking, this goes back, you know, 5,000 years. And they worshipped them as gods. And they said that the Anunnaki were these beings, these gods came from the skies. And they basically came down and taught them everything, agriculture, architecture. They gave them their laws. And they basically set up the whole concept of kingship. So these Anunnaki, allegedly, they weren't from the earth. They came down and they established their dominion over humans. And to me, they sound an awfully lot alike the Nephilim. I really see a close connection between the Anunnaki and the Nephilim.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds exactly like Genesis 6 again, you know, these gods who come down from the sky. Because, I mean, one of the misunderstandings regarding the word God is that you've got it. It's used in a couple of ways in the Bible, but it basically means mighty one. But then you've got Elohim, which Elohim can mean gods, or it can mean the triune God. So even God, the creator, speaks of other gods, even in the Bible. And I forget which psalm it is now, but it says that God sits in the council of the gods.
Yes, it's like a divine council.
Yeah, I've heard it. Yeah, that's what Michael Heiser used to call it, the divine council. But obviously you have the almighty God.
Yes, the God with the big G, and then you have all the gods with the little G's, right?
I find that a lot of Christians get very nervous when you start sort of mentioning gods. And I always say, listen, God himself refers to them as gods. Yes. They're not equal to him. They were created. He's the creator. He is the standalone. He is unique, but he does refer to them that way. So it's correct in saying that there were other gods, but, you know, and like you said, there's Anunnaki. And I know that you mentioned, obviously, they're not from the earth, and there is extraterrestrials because that's what is not from earth. And yes. I've heard Timothy Alberino obviously define that angels are what we call angels. It's not really a descriptive term because angel simply means messenger.
Yes, that's correct.
But it doesn't describe what they actually are, but they actually are extraterrestrials because they're not from Earth.
Absolutely.
You know, but I find even the phrase extraterrestrial can make a lot of Christians nervous as well.
Sure can, yes.
But obviously, because they're thinking you're talking about these little green men and everything. But interestingly, even regarding the aliens, I was talking to Alain Marzouli and we was talking about the Greys, and he says that the Greys, he believes that they're just like an avatar.
I would agree with him. They definitely seem more like an avatar. They're just the even the physical description of them, they don't have any kind of sexual organs. And have you heard of the Nazca mummies? They're raising quite a stir. They were revealed to the Mexican Congress about three or four weeks ago.
I've seen it, and I was
It's
speaking to LA about it.
this goes right into what we're talking about.
I mean, my initial thought is that it was fake.
Right.
I haven't looked into it a lot,
Yes.
so I don't really want to be dogmatic about that. I'd probably have to research it some more.
Good.
What are
Yes.
your thoughts?
Yes. Well, I write about them in my book. I was actually researching these things about 5 years ago. And there's an institute, the Inakari Institute in Peru, have been doing extensive scientific testing on these mummies since that time. And if you go, I would encourage you to go to their website. It is the dash alien dash project.com. And it's a website that has you can find all their scientific papers on these mummies. There's been a lot of documentation, and I'd encourage you to take a look at that site and see what they have on there. Now, I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm not saying these are extraterrestrials. And I'm not saying they're fake either. I'm saying let's take a step back and let's look at the evidence and the scientific testing that's been done, and let's move them over to some other laboratories to be tested, multiple laboratories, and then let's take a look and see what we come up with. I don't necessarily think that they need to be aliens. They could very well be an undiscovered species that we just now found. In fact, I write about this in my book. There was a paleontologist by the name of Dale Russell back in the 1980s. I had a book on dinosaurs, and when I was doing my research and I came across the Nazca mummies, it triggered a memory of me looking through my book and seeing this picture of what is called a dinosaurid, which is a humanoid-looking being. It has elongated head, big eyes, almost gray-like, very similar to a gray, and it has three fingers on each hand and three toes on each foot. And as I pulled that picture back up, I found it online, and I looked at one of the first mummies, a Nazca mummies that was revealed, and I did a side-by-side comparison. I thought these things look very, very similar. And Dale Russell's theory was that if the dinosaurs didn't all die off, or most of them die off 65 million years ago, that some of them would have at least evolved into a humanoid type being. And he had a statue created in the 1980s, and he called it a dinosaurid. And that's the description I was telling you. He had a long, elongated head, a big eyes, and the three fingers and three toes.
Yeah, you made an important statement then. You said about stepping back, and I think that is important, that sometimes we do jump to, like I said, I mean, my initial reaction was, oh, the fake then. But then I was like, right, wait, because I'm always telling people, let's look at the data. Let's see what the
Yes,
data says, you know.
absolutely.
And so I had to put the brakes on myself and say, yeah, let's stop here. It's not fake until you've examined it and you come to that conclusion through research. So I encourage my audience all the time. I said, don't take what I say or my guests say. Yes, these people have done research and so have I, but you need to do your own research as well.
That's how I wrote my book, and that's the way I wanted to portray the information. I cited all my sources. I wanted to leave breadcrumbs for everyone who reads my books to see where did he get the information. And what I would encourage them to do, for those that really want to go deep, is go deeper than I did. I want to kind of light the fuse for you, and maybe you can delve into a certain aspect of my book and go deeper than what I did, and maybe you can find some new information to share.
Yeah, it's I mean, I always have my people who've wrote a book or books, and I think pretty much all of my guests that I've had on so far have either been authors or currently writing a book. I mean, I have an idea in my head for a book, but I'm doing so much research for this podcast. It's like, when do I get time to do that?
Right. Yeah.
But final question, and I've asked this to a couple of my guests. You've heard the story of the Kandahar giant.
I've heard the story of the Kandahar giant, yes.
Do you believe it's a true story? From
That's
what
a
you've
good
heard.
Question. And I'm up in the air on that. I did see the original interview of the alleged, one of the special ops guys that was involved describing the story. Now, the video that I saw, his face was blacked out, so I couldn't see any facial expressions. I thought that he sounded very convincing in what he was saying, like he believed what he was saying. And I also had a friend at that time that was a counterintelligence officer. And I forwarded the video to him and I just said, can you take a look at this? I know you can't see this face because it's blacked out, but could you just listen to this interview? And I just want your opinion on it. And he listened to it. And he basically said, I think the guy believes what he's saying. And that's what he told me. He didn't tell me either way, like, yeah, I believe the guy is telling the truth. But he said the guy that's telling the story definitely believes what he is saying. So, I don't know. Again, I would need some more, I think some more proof beyond just the story to really believe in it. I think it is a very interesting story for sure. I didn't include it in my book. The things I included in my book, I wanted to have a little more evidence beyond just, someone said, heard this story, someone said this,
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I'm not writing it off. I'm not saying that it's false and it didn't happen. It could very well have happened. I'm up in the air. I would need more information on that.
Yeah. I brought it up with Alain Marzulli because the story was broke to him.
Okay.
So originally the guy, the shooter, who they call the shooter,
yeah,
he spoke to Alain Marzulli, and I asked him about it. I wish I'd have asked him about it at the beginning of my episode because I asked him at the end and we didn't have much time left. But interestingly, he told me that the shooter who he interviewed, the footage that you would have seen was stolen footage. And it was uploaded onto YouTube and LA had it taken down. But Stephen Quayle thought that LA had stolen that. But it turns out that they had interviewed two separate guys. And they got their guy together with Steve Quayle's guy. And it turns out that they was in different places. So their stories were relating to two separate giants.
That's interesting because the interview that I heard about this was the one with Stephen Quayle. That was the one that I was watching a documentary and it had that interview on there. And like I said, they had the guy's face blacked out. You couldn't see his face.
Yeah. I mean, that story has also later been corroborated by the pilot, I think one of the, is it an AC-130? It's such an interesting story, but like you said, I mean, who knows? I mean, what I said was that when I was in Afghanistan, I didn't come home with stories of giants. It wasn't something that would have crossed my mind to come home and say, hey, do you know what happened to us today? We had a fight with a giant. It's like,
yes,
you know,
yes.
But soldiers come back with stories. I mean, sometimes they embellish the story that is true, but make it sound maybe a bit more dramatic. But I've often sat there and thought, you know what? I don't know anyone, and including myself, that would have come back and said, yeah, we shot a giant. Like, why would you say that?
Why would you say that? And yeah, and especially military personnel, like, I mean, they are professionals, and why would you put your reputation out there and just make these kind of just really audacious claims unless you really believe this happened or you experienced this? And I've had I recently interviewed a neighbor of mine that had two encounters with Bigfoot, And out in my area where I live in Washington, and Washington and Oregon, that's a hot spot for these sightings of Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And I was just in small talk with this gentleman in my neighborhood, and the subject of Bigfoot got brought up, and he's like, "Bigfoot?" He goes, "I had two encounters with Bigfoot." And he starts telling me like these deep this detailed stories. And I looked at him and I said, "Andy," I said, "have you ever had anyone document these things?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Could I bring my laptop over one of these times? We'll sit down and I'll document them." He said, "Absolutely." I went over there for 2 hours. I documented these encounters that he had with multiple witnesses, by the way. And it was incredible, the amount of detail, and just the emotion that was, I could hear it in his voice. I could see it in his body language. Just amazing.
What do you think it is, Bigfoot? Because I mean, you guys over there know a lot more about Bigfoot because,
Right.
I've read bits of articles about it, and I've seen the odd, I've seen the is it Patterson Gimlin video?
Yes.
I've seen that, and but it's not been a big sort of area of research for me. And I've heard
Yes.
various sort of theories surrounding it. What do you think it is?
Yes. Well, this is a kind of a new area for me as well. In fact, when I do my second book, I am going to include a section in there on the Sasquatch. I definitely believe that it is a physical being that is out there. And they are, most of them are giants. Some have been reported on average to be between 8 and 9 feet tall. So when we're talking about the subject of giants, I mean, we could very well have these giants that exist, to this day in these remote parts of the world. So I definitely believe it's a physical being that it leaves, it traces footprints, and allegedly some of these Sasquatch have killed livestock and that type of thing. So I believe it's a physical being, but it gets interesting because some native tribe, well, actually most native tribes will talk about the Bigfoot, and they all have different names for the Bigfoot. But some tribes believe that it's physical, but it's also a spiritual being too. So it can pop in and out of other dimensions, and that's why we haven't f allegedly found one. That's why you see a trail of footprints, and then they just stop, and they disappear out of nowhere. And so there's different views. Is it just like a physical, like a missing link type thing? Is it just an ape that lives in the forest, or is it something more? Is it some type of interdimensional being that could manifest in the physical form? And all I can say is I know at least in part it is physical, and there's definitely something out there. I've ran into three different people in the past 6 months that have given me very detailed accounts of their experiences with Bigfoot, one of them being a paleontologist.
Well, it's definitely something I probably will look into a little bit further because I have heard a little bit about it, and I'll probably have to get you back on if you're going to be doing some research about Bigfoot, maybe
Yeah.
to talk about that a little bit more in the future.
Absolutely. And in fact, in my book, I reference a discovery that was made in San Diego, in the United States, back in the 1990s. They were doing road construction, and they unearthed the bones of a mastodon. And at the site of the mastodon, there were these stone cobbles. They were looked like stone tools that looked like they were used to break the bones of this mammoth, and the marrow had been sucked out of the bones. And so the interesting thing is, when they dated these bones back, they said they could go back as far as 130,000 years. So here's the situation we have. If those bones are that old, and we have evidence of some type of intelligent species with these stone tools being there and actually sucking the marrow out of probably a freshly dead mammoth, then we have a problem with the timeline, because we're told over here that the first peoples came into North America maybe 20,000 years ago.
Yeah, the timeline is a much debated topic, isn't it? I mean, I tend to be a young Earth creationist,
Yes.
but I mean, it's one of them things that what does the data say? We have to look at the data. I mean, and as a Christian, the Bible doesn't actually specifically tell us how old the Earth is, and it doesn't tell us exactly when mankind was created. I know that young Earth creationists will say, well, we use the genealogies, and that's the explanation. But I'm open to anything as long as it doesn't contradict the Bible. I'm open
Yes.
to it. If it contradicts the Bible, then I'm not open to it,
Yes.
because I believe it fully with my whole heart that it's the word of God. But if it doesn't contradict it and the data is saying a certain thing, then fine. So we'll wrap this up now, Floyd. It's been such a fascinating chat with you. We've gone to a few different places. Could you just tell my audience before you go where they can sort of find you and where they could purchase your book?
Absolutely. So you can find my book at bookbaby.com. On that site, there's a bookshop, and you can find my book there, The Red-Haired Giants of Lovelock Cave and Other Ancient Mysteries. And I'm a self-published author, and BookBaby really is supportive of self-published authors. So if you're interested in purchasing my book, I'd encourage you to go there. I also have it on Amazon and Barnes and Noble as well. It can be found there. I do have a website. It's at theancientgiants.com, and there's more information on my research. There's a chapter breakdown of my book if you want to see what's in each of the chapters of my book, if you're interested in checking that out. And there's more background information on myself and a lot of links to other podcasts that I've done as well.
Okay, thanks for that, Floyd. Well, that's the end of this episode, guys. Thank you for everyone who's a regular listener. Welcome to any new listeners. If you could drop me an email, guys, on and talk to me about what topics you might want to hear. Maybe you want to listen to an episode on Bigfoot. But I'd really encourage people to get involved with this podcast, and you can email me at beyondtheparadigm@yahoo.com. So thank you again, Floyd.
Thank you,
I'll
Paul.
be
It's been
back
an
again.
absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been very interesting, and we've, like I said, we've gone a lot of places.
Yes.
I'll be back next week, guys, with another guest. Thank you for listening. This is Beyond the Paradigm, and I'm Paul.
Am I crazy? We don't use that word in here.